This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoen, filling in for Terry Gross. Cambodia's fragile democracy was destroyed last month when Hun Sen took power in a bloody coup. That forced Prince Norodom Ranariddh, who'd been elected in 1993, into exile. Hun Sen is well known to Cambodians. He led the government through the 1980s and forced Ranariddh to share power with him after that UN-sponsored election. Cambodia is still recovering from the brutal regime of Pol Pot, who controlled the country from 1975 to 1979. His reign of terror, carried out by the Khmer Rouge, turned the country into a virtual prison camp, which resulted in more than 1 million deaths through execution, starvation, and disease. Pol Pot had been an elusive figure since his government was overthrown in 1979. He and members of the Khmer Rouge loyal to him had disappeared into the jungles of Cambodia. That all changed last month when Pol Pot faced his accusers, who denounced him for the violence he perpetrated on his country. The only Western journalist to witness this trial was Nate Thayer. He's been living and working in Southeast Asia since the early 80s. He's a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review and a visiting scholar at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Earlier today, we called him at his hotel room in Bangkok, and I wanted to know why he was allowed to witness the trial.
Well, it's quite clear that, the whole trial, or in fact tribunal, of Pol Pot was put on specifically for me to witness. The Khmer Rouge had announced the purge and arrest of Pol Pot more than a month before. It came after a very serious internal dispute at the very core of the Khmer Rouge leadership. They'd announced it on their radio. The international community, for reasonable reasons, believed nothing of what they said. And it was necessary for them to bring in an independent, credible witness to be able to see for themselves that, in fact, Pol Pot had been eliminated from the leadership of the organization of which we know of as the Khmer Rouge.
Pol Pot had not been seen for almost two decades. Describe what he looked like.
It was really a tragic scene. It was a surreal scene. Here was a man who was responsible for the destruction of the lives of millions and millions of people in Cambodia, and who had mesmerized the world. And he was a utterly defeated, traumatized, failed figure on both a personal and political level. I felt great pity on a human level to watch him being denounced by his last loyalists in a remote jungle stronghold in one of the most inaccessible areas on the planet. It was, in fact, his final minutes. And for a man who had devoted his life to a certain vision, this was the end. And everything that he had worked for, in fact, as we were watching, was being denounced, and was being denounced as a failure. And on a human level, it was tragic.
You describe this trial as looking rather like the communist-style denunciation trials that appeared and happened during the Cultural Revolution. Describe for us what preceded, what you observed.
Well, it was a classic Asian communist, not a show trial. A show trial involves supposed lawyers and judges and so on. It was a people's mass tribunal whose purpose was to denounce and humiliate political enemies. They were crowds of hundreds and hundreds of people dressed in Chinese drab green uniforms, many of them, a shocking percentage of them, in fact, without arms, without legs, without eyes, who were victims and loyalists of the Pol Pot's vision of Cambodia's revolution, who were denouncing him.
What were they shouting? What insults were they hurling at Pol Pot?
Well, there were a series of speakers representing, again, in traditional Asian Maoist communist style, representing the intellectual, representing the farmer, representing the army, representing women who came to denounce him, who were interrupted by quite clearly orchestrated slogans. And it was quite a stark contrast, given that they were shouting slogans such as "Long live the emerging democracy" or "Long live the emerging new strategy," in clearly classic communist style, they were in fact endorsing the end of this ideology.
How did Pol Pot respond to the charges against him, the insults that were thrown at him?
Here was a man who was so traumatized that you could see that every ounce of his body, every core of his being, was attempting to maintain some semblance of dignity. He was on the verge of tears. His cheeks were shaking as in really profound psychological trauma, attempting to not break down during this process. Here was a man who was seeing his life work, his life vision, being denounced by the last of the last of his loyalists. And it was a profound moment on a human level, but it was also a historic moment, because Pol Pot no longer will be ever a figure of political significance in Cambodia's future, a man who in Cambodia's past has dominated that country and mesmerized the world for many, many decades.
Pol Pot was a brutal, sadistic dictator. Did you feel any sympathy for him as he sat at this tribunal?
Absolutely. I felt great sympathy on a human level. I mean, I personally don't subscribe to the concept of revenge, and I felt great sympathy for him, for any human being who had to go through what he had to go through during those hours that day. His whole life work was being denounced, and what he had done, and what he had done, which had so terribly affected millions and millions of people, was being denounced as wrong. And for him as a human being, I'm sure that it was a catharsis. I indeed felt that there was a great possibility that, given his frail physical health combined with the psychological trauma, that he may have died while we were watching him. It was this kind of historic moment.
But there are many worse fates than being insulted and having one's life work shot down and shouted down by others. I mean, it seems in certain ways that a more brutal response to what he had done would be very understandable.
Sure. And in fact, it was a great debate within the leadership of the Khmer Rouge. Remember that what we witnessed and what we photographed and what we documented through video was an event that actually took place weeks before. This was for international consumption through us. And during that debate weeks before, they had considered executing him. And they had considered a number of different options. They had chosen to let him live out his final days under armed guard and essential house arrest. And many people, I'm sure it's a natural response to seek revenge. But the larger issue is, in my mind, much more important, and that is that Pol Pot is finished, that his reign of terror, his being on the edge of politics, or being in the center of politics, or being involved at all in Cambodia's political future, is now finished. And for foreigners, that's important. But for foreigners, obviously, justice has not been served. But for Cambodians, on a psychological level, it allows some level of closure to an issue that has affected them so profoundly personally.
You say he's under house arrest. Where is Pol Pot today, then?
Pol Pot is being kept in a house in the mountainous jungles of northern Cambodia, still controlled by the remaining elements of his organization. He is being kept under armed guard. In my view, quite clearly, he is living out the last days of his life. We are no longer really looking at the issue of Pol Pot as a political figure. If he died in the next days, if he died in the next weeks, it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Were you given an opportunity to interview Pol Pot?
Pol Pot, yes, the answer is yes, that the schedule was to first go through this show trial and then afterwards interview Pol Pot. But because of the trauma of the trial itself, he was literally unable to talk. He was unable to walk. He looked literally deathly ill and psychologically traumatized.
If you had had the opportunity to interview Pol Pot, what would you have wanted to ask him?
The question I wanted to ask, or the series of questions that I wanted to ask, was whether that he felt that what he had done during his years in power was wrong, whether he felt any remorse for the suffering that he had inflicted on millions of people. And that question remains unanswered. Does Pol Pot know what he has done to so many, many people who did not deserve the destruction and suffering that they have experienced because of one man, Pol Pot?
In this tribunal that you observe with Pol Pot on trial, what do you think the Khmer Rouge hoped to gain from that trial? What were their motives?
It was quite clear that the motives of the destruction of Pol Pot were rooted in the desire of the overwhelming majority of the Khmer Rouge to seek a political solution and end the revolution. They wanted a political solution because of their profound isolation, and they are seeking both domestic and international credibility and support, and to go into a tactical alliance with the democratically elected government, which is now a resistance army, to overthrow their common enemy, the Cambodian People's Party, which is in power after the coup d'etat in Phnom Penh.
You said this was a genuine trial, that it was not a hoax. What makes you so certain? And the reason I ask is that others are more suspicious of what the Khmer Rouge was up to.
Well, I didn't say it was a genuine trial. It's not a trial. It's a mass people's tribunal. It's a classic Asian-style tribunal to denounce political enemies. This kind of trial is never held. This kind of public humiliation, particularly in front of foreigners, is never held unless, in fact, these so-called enemies are in fact considered as such by those in power. There is not a scintilla of doubt in my mind, and in fact in any serious scholar's mind, on the one issue that Pol Pot is finished and is out of any position of control, leadership, or influence of any political organization in Cambodia today. There are a number of other questions. Pol Pot himself was not responsible for the killing and suffering of millions and millions of people, which raises much larger questions. Was justice done during these dramatic events last week? The answer is no. But the question of whether Pol Pot has finished and has been turned against by his own last loyalists, the answer is yes.
When you talk about Pol Pot on trial, and you talk about the kind of sympathy you had for a man whose philosophy was really being shouted down, What was Pol Pot's philosophy, his ideology, that he brought to bear on Cambodia?
You know, this is a question that continues to be debated by scholars even 20 years after his years in power. Was Pol Pot a Maoist? Was Pol Pot a Stalinist? Where did he get the roots of his political philosophy? In fact, what we're obsessed with, which was the brutality and the terrible reign of power that was the reality during that period between 1975 and 1979, is rooted in the brutality of Khmer political culture, the requirement for total obsequiousness to those in power, and the refusal to allow any form of dissent or debate. And these issues really are not ideological. They're rooted in political culture. When you allow communism to mix with Khmer political culture, you end up with people like Pol Pot in the 1970s, and you end up with people like Hun Sen in July 1997.
My guest is Nate Thayer, correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. We'll talk more about Cambodia after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to journalist Nate Thayer. We're talking about Cambodia. In the early 1990s, the United Nations made an effort to rehabilitate Cambodia and spent millions of dollars to create democratic institutions. What were they able to accomplish in Cambodia?
Nothing. That money went down a black hole. The UN had elections in 1993. The purpose of more than $4 billion of international assistance was to root democratic institutions, which clearly was the goal of the overwhelming majority of Cambodians who were tired and fed up with the suffering and warfare and turmoil which has consumed them for more than 27 years. The reaction of the international community clearly has been a betrayal. They are now supporting dictatorship. The use of armed force 3 weeks ago to overthrow the UN-sponsored and legitimized democratically elected government has resulted in hundreds and hundreds of people who have been summarily executed and tortured. It has resulted in the total destruction of a free press. All 19 opposition newspapers have fled. Many have been killed. Many are now in the jungles. Many have fled by boat, by plane, by foot to other countries. The parliament is a rubber stamp. Any kind of opposition parties have been totally destroyed. And that is the reality of Cambodia today, which is in many ways more important than the drama of what happened with Pol Pot in the remote jungles of northern Cambodia with a political movement which had been increasingly isolated and irrelevant in recent years.
Pol Pot was overthrown in 1979. There were then elections in the early 90s. Who was running Cambodia? What was the government between those two time intervals?
The government that's in power today after the coup d'etat is the exact same government which was the ex-Khmer Rouge installed by the Vietnamese invading army in 1979. They were in power between 1979 and the UN-sponsored election and Paris peace agreements. They lost the elections. They launched a military coup to refuse to recognize the elections. A coalition arrangement was made through the intervention of the international community that resulted in a shaky government that has lasted until the coup d'etat, when those that were rejected during those elections have now returned to power, and those that were elected are now back in the jungle fighting a very, very difficult civil war.
When you talk about the trial of Pol Pot and then you talk about the coup of last month, are those two separate incidents? Does one have anything to do with the other?
Absolutely. They're deeply, deeply linked. What was happening was that for many months elements of the Khmer Rouge, not supported by Pol Pot, were involved in secret negotiations with the elected government of Cambodia to surrender. They were looking to go into a tactical military and political alliance in a united front with the Phun Sen Pek Party. After the purge of Pol Pot, because he was opposed to those negotiations, those negotiations moved forward rapidly. They were completed between the Khmer Rouge and Prince Ranarit's Phun Sen Pek Party on the night of the 4th of July. On the morning of the 5th, Hun Sen launched his coup. There is no coincidence here. It was because Hun Sen saw clearly that he was internally politically isolated in the run-up to elections, which were scheduled to next year. It was a coalition of virtually all Cambodian opposition political parties who were in alliance with those who had won the elections against his Cambodian People's Party, and that is why the coup was launched.
Well, Nate Thayer, thank you very much for giving us so much of your time. Thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Nate Thayer is a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. He's been covering events in Southeast Asia, most notably Cambodia, for more than 15 years. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.